Dune by Frank Herbert, continued. It's been so long since guerrillas were effective that the mighty have forgotten how to fight them, Paul said. The Sardaukar have played into our hands. They grabbed some city women for their sport, decorated their battle standards with the heads of the men who objected, and they've built up a fever of hate among people who otherwise would have looked on the coming battle as no more than a great inconvenience, and the possibility of exchanging one set of masters for another. The Sardaukar recruit for us, Stilgar. The city people do seem eager, Stilgar said. Their hate is fresh and clear, Paul said. That's why we use them as shock troops. The slaughter among them will be fearful, Gurney said. Stilgar nodded agreement. They were told the odds, Paul said. They know every Sardaukar they kill will be one less for us. You see, gentlemen, they have something to die for. They've discovered they're a people. They're awakening. A muttered exclamation came from the watcher at the telescope. Paul moved to the rock slit, asked, What is it out there?
A great commotion, Muad'Dib, the watcher hissed. At that monstrous metal tent, a surface car came from Rimwall West, and it was like a hawk into a nest of rock partridge.
Our captive Sardaukar have arrived, Paul said.
They've a shield around the entire landing field now, the watcher said. I can see the air dancing even to the edge of the storage yard where they kept the spice.
Now they know who it is they fight, Gurney said. Let the Harkonnen beasts tremble and fret themselves that an Atreides yet lives.
Paul spoke to the Fedakin at the telescope. Watch the flagpole atop the Emperor's ship. If my flag is raised there, it will not be, Gurney said. Paul saw the puzzled frown on Stilgar's face, said, If the Emperor recognized my claim, he'll signal by restoring the Atreides flag to Arrakis. We'll use the second plan then, move only against the Harkonnens. The Sardaukar will stand aside and let us settle the issue between ourselves.
I've no experience with these off-world things, Stilgar said. I've heard of them, but it seems unlikely that...
You don't need experience to know what they'll do, Gurney said.
They're sending a new flag up on the tall ship, the watcher said. The flag is yellow, with a black and red circle in the center.
There's a subtle piece of business, Paul said. The Chome Company flag.
It's the same as the flag at the other ships, the Fedakin guard said.
I don't understand, Stilgar said.
A subtle piece of business indeed, Gurney said. Had he sent up the Atreides banner, he'd have had to live by what that meant. Too many observers about. He could have signaled with the Harkonnen flag on his staff, a flat declaration that'd have been. But no, he sends up the Chome rag. He's telling the people up there, Gurney pointed toward space, where the prophet is. He's saying he doesn't care if it's an Atreides here or not.
How long till the storm strikes the shield wall? Paul asked. Stilgar turned away, consulted one of the Fedakin in the bowl. Presently he returned, said,
Very soon, Muad'Dib. Sooner than we expected. It's a great-great-grandmother of a storm. Perhaps even more than you wished.
It's my storm, Paul said, and saw the silent awe on the faces of the Fedakin who heard him. Though it shook the entire world, it could not be more than I wished.
Will it strike the shield wall full on?
Close enough to make no difference, Stilgar said.
A courier crossed from the hole that led down into the basin, said,
The Sardaukar and Harkonnen patrols are pulling back, Muad'Dib.
They expect the storm to spill too much sand into the basin for good visibility, Stilgar said. They think we'll be in the same fix.
Tell our gunners to set their sights well before visibility drops, Paul said. They must knock the nose off every one of those ships as soon as the storm has destroyed the shields. He stepped to the wall of the bowl, pulled back a fold of the camouflage cover, and looked up at the sky. The horsetail twistings of blow sand could be seen against the dark of the sky. Paul restored the cover, said,
Start sending our men down, Still.
Will you not go with us? Stilgar asked.
I'll wait here a bit with the Fedakin, Paul said.
Stilgar gave a knowing shrug toward Gurney, moved to the hole in the rock wall, was lost in its shadows.
The trigger that blasts the shield wall aside, that I leave in your hands, Gurney, Paul said.
You will do it?
I'll do it.
Paul gestured to a Fedakin lieutenant, said, Othame, start moving the Czech patrols out of the blast area. They must be out of there before the storm strikes. The man bowed, followed Stilgar.
Gurney leaned in to the rock slit, spoke to the man at the telescope. Keep your attention on the south wall. It'll be completely undefended until we blow it.
Dispatch a Cielago with a time signal, Paul ordered.
Some ground cars are moving toward the south wall, the man at the telescope said. Some are using projector weapons, testing. Our people are using body shields as you commanded. The ground cars have stopped.
In the abrupt silence, Paul heard the wind devils playing overhead, the front of the storm. Sand began to drift down into their bowl through gaps in the cover. A burst of wind caught the cover, whipped it away. Paul motioned his Fedakin to take shelter, crossed to the men at the communications equipment near the tunnel mouth.
Gurney stayed beside him. Paul crouched over the signalmen. One said,
"A great, great, great grandmother of a storm, Muad'Dib."
Paul glanced up at the darkening sky, said, "Gurney, have the south wall observers pulled out." He had to repeat his order, shouting above the growing noise of the storm. Gurney turned to obey. Paul fastened his face filter, tightened the stillsuit hood. Gurney returned. Paul touched his shoulder, pointed to the blast trigger set into the tunnel mouth beyond the signalmen. Gurney went into the tunnel, stopped there, one hand at the trigger, his gaze on Paul.
"We are getting no messages," the signalman beside Paul said. "Much static."
Paul nodded, kept his eye on the time standard dial in front of the signalman. Presently, Paul looked at Gurney, raised a hand, returned his attention to the dial. The time counter crawled around its final circuit.
"Now!"
Paul shouted, and dropped his hand. Gurney depressed the blast trigger. It seemed that a full second passed before they felt the ground beneath them ripple and shake. A rumbling sound was added to the storm's roar. The Fedakin watcher from the telescope appeared beside Paul, the telescope clutched under one arm.
"The shield wall is breached, Muad'Dib!" he shouted. "The storm is on them, and our gunners already are firing!"
Paul thought of the storm sweeping across the basin, the static charge within the wall of sand that destroyed every shield barrier in the enemy camp.
"The storm!" someone shouted. "We must get under cover, Muad'Dib!"
Paul came to his senses, feeling the sand needles sting his exposed cheeks.
"We are committed," he thought.
He put an arm around the signalman's shoulder, said,
"Leave the equipment. There's more in the tunnel."
He felt himself being pulled away. Fedakin pressed around him to protect him. They squeezed into the tunnel mouth, feeling its comparative silence, turned a corner into a small chamber with glow globes overhead, and another tunnel opening beyond. Another signalman sat there at his equipment.
"Much static," the man said.
A swirl of sand filled the air around them.
"Seal off this tunnel," Paul shouted.
A sudden pressure of stillness showed that his command had been obeyed.
"Is the way down to the basin still open?" Paul asked.
A Fedakin went to look, returned, said,
"The explosion caused a little rock to fall, but the engineers say it is still open. They're cleaning up with laser beams." "Tell them to use their hands," Paul barked. "There are shields active down there."
"They are being careful, Muad'Dib," the man said, but he turned to obey. The signalmen from outside pressed past them carrying their equipment.
"I told those men to leave their equipment," Paul said. "Fremen do not like to abandon equipment, Muad'Dib,"
one of his Fedakin chided.
"Men are more important than equipment now," Paul said. "We'll have more equipment than we can use soon, or have no need for any equipment."
Gurney Halleck came up beside him, said,
"I heard them say the way down is open. We are very close to the surface here, my lord. Should the Harkonnens try to retaliate in kind?"
"They're in no position to retaliate," Paul said. "They're just now finding out that they have no shields, and are unable to get off Arrakis."
"The new command post is all prepared, though, my lord,"
Gurney said.
"They've no need of me in the command post yet," Paul said. "The plan would go ahead without me. We must wait for the—"
"I'm getting a message, Muad'Dib," said the signalman at the communications equipment. The man shook his head, pressed the receiver phone against his ear.
"Much static."
He began scribbling on a pad in front of him, shaking his head, waiting, writing, waiting. Paul crossed to the signalman's side. The Fedakin stepped back, giving him room. He looked down at what the man had written, read,
"Raid. On Siege Tabor. Captives. Alia, blank, families of, blank, dead are... They, blank, son of Muad'Dib."
Again the signalman shook his head. Paul looked up to see Gurney staring at him.
"The message is garbled," Gurney said. "The static. You don't know that—"
"My son is dead," Paul said, and he knew as he spoke that it was true.
"My son is dead, and Alia is a captive, hostage."
He felt emptied, a shell without emotions. Everything he touched brought death and grief, and it was like a disease that could spread across the universe. He could feel the old man wisdom, the accumulation out of the experiences from countless possible lives. Something seemed to chuckle and rub its hands within him. And Paul thought, how little the universe knows about the nature of real cruelty.
And Muad'Dib stood before them, and he said,
"Though we deem the captive dead, yet does she live. For her seed is my seed, and her voice is my voice, and she sees unto the farthest reaches of possibility. Yea, unto the veil of the unknowable does she see because of me."
From Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen stood with eyes downcast in the Imperial Audience Chamber, the oval salamlik within the Padishah Emperor's hutment. With covert glances, the Baron had studied the metal-walled room and its occupants, the nukers, the pages, the guards, the troop of House Sardaukar drawn up around the walls, standing at ease there beneath the bloody and tattered captured battle flags that were the room's only decoration. Voices sounded from the right of the chamber, echoing out of a high passage.
"Make way! Make way for the royal person!"
The Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV came out of the passage into the audience chamber, followed by his suite. He stood waiting while his throne was brought, ignoring the Baron, seemingly ignoring every person in the room. The Baron found that he could not ignore the royal person, and studied the Emperor for a sign, any clue to the purpose of this audience. The Emperor stood poised, waiting, a slim, elegant figure in a gray Sardaukar uniform with silver and gold trim. His thin face and cold eyes reminded the Baron of the Duke Leto long dead. There was that same look of the predatory bird. But the Emperor's hair was red, not black, and most of that hair was concealed by a Bursig's ebon helmet with the imperial crest in gold upon its crown. Pages brought the throne. It was a massive chair carved from a single piece of Hagal quartz, blue-green translucency shot through with streaks of yellow fire. They placed it on the dais, and the Emperor mounted, seated himself. An old woman in a black abba robe, with hood drawn down over her forehead, detached herself from the Emperor's suite, took up station behind the throne, one scrawny hand resting on the quartz back. Her face peered out of the hood like a witch caricature, sunken cheeks and eyes, an overlong nose, skin mottled and with protruding veins. The Baron stilled his trembling at sight of her. The presence of the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, the Emperor's truth-sayer, betrayed the importance of this audience. The Baron looked away from her, studied the suite for a clue. There were two of the guild agents, one tall and fat, one short and fat, both with bland gray eyes. And among the lackeys stood one of the Emperor's daughters, the Princess Irulan, a woman, they said, was being trained in the deepest of the Bene Gesserit ways, destined to be a reverend mother. She was tall, blonde, face of chiseled beauty, green eyes that looked past and through him.
"My dear Baron!"
The Emperor had deigned to notice him. The voice was baritone and with exquisite control. It managed to dismiss him while greeting him. The Baron bowed low, advanced to the required position 10 paces from the dais.
"I came at your summons, Majesty."
"Summons?" the old witch cackled.
"Now, Reverend Mother,"
the Emperor chided, but he smiled at the Baron's discomfiture, said,
"First, you will tell me where you've sent your minion, Thufir Hawat."
The Baron darted his gaze left and right, reviled himself for coming here without his own guards. Not that they'd be much use against Sardaukar. Still...
"Well," the Emperor said, "he has been gone these 5 days, Majesty."
The Baron shot a glance at the guild agents, back to the Emperor.
"He was to land at a smuggler base and attempt infiltrating the camp of the Fremen fanatic, this Muad'Dib."
"Incredible," the Emperor said. One of the witch's claw-like hands tapped the Emperor's shoulder. She leaned forward, whispered in his ear. The Emperor nodded, said,
"5 days, Baron. Tell me, why aren't you worried about his absence?"
"But I am worried, Majesty."
The Emperor continued to stare at him, waiting. The Reverend Mother emitted a cackling laugh.
"What I mean, Majesty," the Baron said, "is that Hawat will be dead within another few hours anyway."
And he explained about the latent poison and need for an antidote.
"How clever of you, Baron," the Emperor said. "And where are your nephews, Raban, and the young Fade Rotha?"
"The storm comes, Majesty. I sent them to inspect our perimeter, lest the Fremen attack under cover of the sand."
"Perimeter," the Emperor said.
The word came out as though it puckered his mouth.
"The storm won't be much here in the basin, and that Fremen rabble won't attack while I'm here with 5 legions of Sardaukar."
"Surely not, Majesty," the Baron said. "But error on the side of caution cannot be censured."
"Ah," the Emperor said. "Censure. Then I'm not to speak of how much time this Arrakis nonsense has taken from me?"